You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
The European response to the war in Ukraine, a legal analysis. This was a rapid reaction seminar held by the Centre for European Law at King's College London on Thursday last week. The question for the experts was, what role can European Union law play in the current conflict, and does it present any potential ways out? King's College kindly agreed to let us wrap up and repost some of the main points made by the speakers. The event itself was an hour and a half long, including the Q&A section at the end. Here, I'll try and summarise the main points, and you'll hear some of the speakers in turn as they address the following issues. The use of sanctions under European Union law, the role of human rights and the Council of Europe, the nuclear threat and the use of weapons. The first delegate to speak was Roman Pietrov, Professor of EU Law at the National University of Kyiv-Mohyla Academy. Professor Pietrov, who'd been in the thick of it, as it were, had some sharp comments to make about war as a subject of study, of entertainment even. Suddenly, he said, when you wake up in the morning to the sound of shelling, you change your behaviour. He explains why he had to leave Kyiv with his family early on in the crisis.
The situation in the country is surprisingly more or less stable because all major infrastructure functions and people don't experience ordeals everywhere except to the combat zones. Unfortunately, major university centers and big cities like Kharkiv, Sumy, Mariupol, they are on the verge of humanitarian catastrophe. And of course, it's a great challenge for international law and international humanitarian law lawyers how to qualify and how to take Russia responsible for all these atrocities that happen. And therefore, all this ordeal caused mass migration within the country. Basically, Western cities like Lviv, Ternopil, Ivano-Frankivsk, and others, they have fled with the people from Kyiv and from the east. And we all try to cope with this as much as we can. And we, of course, all quite not even surprised, but we are proud of our military, of our army being able, and also local militia being able to resist, provide resistance, really national-wide movement. People do everything possible. Lots of people volunteer. So it's actually a moment, very rare moment in Ukrainian history when we even didn't experience in times of our two revolutions when the whole country really shows solidarity in patriotism and self-assistance and defense.
Swiftly moving on to the question of EU law, Professor Pietrov referred to the growing discussion of the need for a special tribunal to adjudicate breaches of international law and his country's frustrated application to join the European Union.
Now, of course, what is the most discussed and most explored issue in within the EU-Ukraine relations? Of course, this recent application of Ukraine on behalf of the Ukrainian president for the membership in the EU. It was done by the letter of the president of Ukraine on February 28th. And we all know that any European country, according to the Treaty of the European Union, may apply. And this major criteria of Ukraine as a European country, of course, was confirmed in the preamble of the EU-Ukraine Association Agreement. It was a big deal at that time. It was a compromise. Instead of recognizing any right for Ukraine to be considered as a candidate country, preamble of the EU-Ukraine Association Agreement contains this clear-cut provision recognizing Ukraine as a European country, thereby allowing Ukraine to apply anytime. Of course, the Ukrainian government considered this chance and opportunity as a special case to be triggered in a special circumstances. So possibly on February 28th, in times of the just launched aggression, the Ukrainian government, especially the office of the president of Ukraine, decided to trigger this provision. Why they did it? Of course, I can only share my personal observations. Because sort of recognition of the possibility of membership of Ukraine in the EU always has been considered as a very important moral boost factor for the for Ukrainians. And I'm, of course, I was quite reserved on this statement and on this on using this possibility in these circumstances all the time. But I must admit that today, in today's circumstances, it's possibly a very important step to do, because any sort of moral support and moral assistance is important for Ukrainians, especially knowing quite harsh demands on behalf of the Russian government as a pretext of introducing a ceasefire.
We all understand that the European Union will be facing some very difficult questions with regard to energy supply. In other words, oil and gas from Russia, the forefront of these member states being Germany.
All the sanctions, they also not only harm, they also, of course, harm the Russian economy, but also would reflect on the EU. It's understandable. But certainly, it must be admitted that even if the conflict, the war is over very soon, EU-Ukraine relations would not be the same and cannot be the same as they were before. As a protagonist of the EU-Ukraine Association Agreement, I must again reiterate it and admit that it's already outdated. And it was created, negotiated in completely different geopolitical and economic circumstances.
Ona Stefan, chairing the conference, next turned the focus on Luigi Leonardo, lecturer in European Union law at University College Cork. Are we witnessing, she asked, a revolution in EU foreign and security policy because of the response to the war in Ukraine? Whoever thought of funding weapons when drafting the founding treaties of the EU?
I think the Russian invasion of Ukraine has shook shaken European conscience, and not only European conscience. Conceptually, the invasion calls into question the principle of self-determination. It is aimed at coercing Ukraine into a Russian sphere of influence, and militarily, land acquisition by conquest and the threat of nuclear war throws Europe back to the darkest hours of the 20th century.
It was generally agreed amongst the speakers that the hour of Europe has not yet come. The EU has tried to provide assistance to Ukraine indirectly by providing finance through its member states. It's important to stress that it has no power to bind its member states to transfer military equipment to Ukraine. The role of the EU in terms of financing and arming was first done through the European Peace Facility, which was itself part of the European Common and Foreign Security Policy. This facility does not finance Kyiv, it only finances member states. And the cost of providing lethal force, as well as the provision of non-lethal assistance, is borne by all the member states of the EU. In Leonardo's view, the EU should perhaps better rely on trade and sanctions rather than granting export license for lethal weapons and thus being more directly involved in military operations.
Now, is such decision to provide equipment designed to deliver lethal force wise? One might take the view that the EU response should better focus on trade, for example, through sanctions, and humanitarian assistance rather than being involved more directly with military operations. The reason for that is threefold. First, the US position of not putting boots on the ground to avoid an escalation has merits, even though both Europeans and the US may soon need to reconsider this stance. Second, the respective roles of NATO and the EU suggest that the EU action should focus on humanitarian actions and trade measures. And third, following from the second, the EU has as such mutually no expertise in the hard core of military matters.
Again, it's important to emphasize that the EU itself is not providing anything. It's just financing its member states. There is no acquisition of any new EU competence going on here.
So in conclusion, I think that the invasion of Ukraine will force a rebirth of European strategic thinking, and more generally, it will force us to rethink the security architecture in Europe as it emerged after World War II and as it evolved after the end of the Cold War.
Professor Takis Tridimas, is Professor of European Union Law at King's College London. His brief in this seminar was to comment on the implementation of economic sanctions by the EU against Russia. He started by reminding us of the avowal in the founding treaty of the European Union to, in quotes, share its values in the neighbourhood. So there is an obligation for the EU to respond when there's been a clear breach of international law. As we know, Poland wanted to provide fighter jets to Ukraine, but that is not permitted by EU powers. Any decision to provide lethal force goes against the characterisation of the EU as a civilian body. But it goes without saying that this current crisis unsettles the underpinning of the liberal order since the fall of the Berlin Wall. So will Putin's belligerence force us to rethink the EU as a security force? Professor Tridimas reminds us that any use of lethal force would be an antithesis to the EU's founding norms, which are, or were, defensive in character, at least when the Berlin Wall came down.
The aphorism of the Belgian Foreign Minister Aeskens back in 1991, that Europe is an economic giant, a political dwarf, and a military worm, I think reverberates. I don't necessarily agree with that aphorism, but I think it is a poignant time to revisit it.
According to Professor Tridimas, this war may change the integration paradigm and test solidarity at European level in a way that it has not been tested before. The EU has used so-called smart sanctions since 9/11, and the heavy hand of diplomacy as a substitute for lack of military power against individuals and countries since then. Sanctions against Russia were first introduced by the EU following Russia's invasion of Crimea in 2014. Tridimas sets out the EU taxonomy of sanctions. There are diplomatic measures, individual restrictive measures such as asset freezes and travel restrictions, restrictions on economic relations with Crimea and Sevastopol, sanctions on the media, and restrictions on economic cooperation. Is it wise for the EU to impose these sanctions? It's primarily an economic organisation. And will these sanctions even be effective? Tridimas thinks the jury is out on this question.
Traditionally, sanctions fall short of facilitating, of bringing about the change of behaviour that they are intended to bring about. So there's a very vibrant debate in politics and also in academic discourse about the effectiveness of sanctions. One will have to wait and see. I think it is correct to say that these sanctions are unprecedented. They have already had an effect on Russia. The ruble has lost 33% almost of its value. There are sanctions on all sorts of imports. Now, I understand that only one third of Russian imports accounts for consumer goods. The rest are capital goods or intermediate goods that are used for the production or the manufacturing of other products. It appears from the international press that the aviation industry may be particularly affected as a result of controls in the exportation of various components. There is, of course, the elephant in the room, and this is the energy supply from Russia. This has not overall been affected. The energy supply refers mostly to gas, not to oil. I think Europe is a lot more dependent on Russian gas than it is on Russian oil. And there is no doubt that sanctions will hurt not only Russia, but also those that impose them.
So what is the legal basis for economic sanctions applied by the European Union? Not a question to be explored in detail here. Suffice it to say that Article 215 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, TFEU, provides a legal basis for the interruption or reduction, in part or completely, of the Union's economic and financial relations with one or more third countries where such restrictive measures are necessary to achieve the objectives of the common foreign and security policy. When the EU first started to use sanctions in early 2000s, there was a high rate of success challenging these sanctions in JR before the European Court of Justice. The EU is now a lot more careful in justifying the imposition of sanctions.
In a nutshell, the sanctions have been unprecedented, very wide-ranging. It remains to be seen how effective they are. It remains to be seen what effect they will have on the EU. And I think by way of conclusion, again, it's early days, but I think it is important to consider the aftermath of the Ukraine crisis. It is an unprecedented crisis. It is extremely sad. And it is, as I said, the antithesis of Article 2 of the European Union. Everything that the EU stands for, and indeed anything that the international law stands for. But we would need to consider the day after. How can Russia be accommodated following the crisis? I think because that is a key issue for the strategic interests of Europe.
Now we move on to human rights. The Council of Europe, not to be confused with the European Union, is the governing body of the European Convention on Human Rights and the contracting states that signed up to it. Unlike the European Union, the Council used to have as its members both Ukraine and Russia. On the 15th of March, 5 days after the King's College conference was held, Russia resigned from the Council. Konstantin Detsiaru is Professor of Human Rights Law at the University of Liverpool. He's pragmatic about the situation. He pointed out in the conference that if Russia left the Council of Europe, which of course it has just done, the Strasbourg Court will be left with a huge backlog of individual and interstate applications.
And the whole system is designed for like-minded countries that are willing to collaborate. If a country does not want to collaborate, the Council of Europe has very limited toolkits at its disposal. And this is the reason for the Council of Europe really to rethink itself.
We have to remind ourselves that the Strasbourg Court is neither able nor equipped to prevent mass-scale human rights violations. As Russia has now withdrawn from the Council of Europe, its citizens will have no avenue for redress regarding violations of the Convention on Human Rights and Freedoms. And on that somber note, we leave the King's College event and address the Q&A session. I can't include all the questions here, but one from Alan Dashwood QC of Henderson Chambers elicited a very interesting response from Professor Tridimas.
Professor Dashwood's question was quite straightforward. If Ukraine is forced to agree to an unfavourable settlement preceding ceasefire, can and should the EU maintain the sanctions against Russia?
I don't think that a settlement, irrespective of its content, is in itself something that would render the continuation of sanctions illegal. I think the EU has a lot of discretion, really. Almost all of the cases decided by the court have to do with process rights rather than substance, with some exceptions, but and none of them have to do really with the wider policy issue. How does the EU choose which countries or which individuals to sanction? So I don't think there will be a legal incompatibility. Should the EU continue them? Again, I think it depends on the circumstances. It is not clear to me that an unfavorable settlement that runs against the values and the interests of the EU would be a good reason for the EU to stop the sanctions.
We're certainly in uncharted territory here. The European Union was forged in crisis. Some say that this gives the member countries of the Union an opportunity to draw closer. Others argue that the EU, as currently configured, is no longer fit for purpose. As we speak, the threat of war looms over the continent of Europe, and it is only highly informed discussions like this that give a glimmer into what the future looks like. Thanks to King's College Centre of European Law for organising this event, and allowing us to summarise it here on LawPod UK.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.